This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, a space science update. A bit later, we'll talk about the Voyager 1 spacecraft reaching the edge of the solar system. But first, if you recall, just a few weeks ago, last month, huge solar storms bombarded Earth with highly charged particles, setting off a spectacular display of the northern lights, but also causing blackouts, damaging satellites, and upsetting radio communications. Airplanes were rerouted to avoid exposure to larger-than-usual doses of radiation. And watching all of this solar mayhem from a unique vantage point is a spacecraft called Ulysses. Ulysses has been orbiting the sun and collecting information about solar activity for more than a decade. And this week in the journal Science, researchers published observations made by the spacecraft during a period of intense solar activity that started in 1998. So we'll kick off the hour by talking with Ulysses scientists about what they're discovering about the sun and how a better understanding of space weather, can we predict it? Well, can it help us prepare for solar storms here on Earth? So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you find links to the topic today. Let me introduce my guests. Louis Lanzerotti is a principal investigator for NASA's Ulysses mission. He's a consulting physicist at Bell Labs Lucent Technologies and a distinguished research professor in the Department of Physics Center for Solar Terrestrial Research at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. He joins us today from the studios of member station WBGO in Newark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm certainly a pleasure to be here.
Terrific. Edward Smith is the NASA project scientist for the Ulysses mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He joins us today in our NPR West studios in L.A. Welcome to the program, Dr. Smith.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning, Lou. Yes, it's good afternoon
Good afternoon, Ed.
I guess you know each other.
Well, we were just with one another this week at a Ulysses Science Working Team meeting, as a matter of fact.
Let's talk about what Ulysses is circling the sun and going in an unusual north-south polar orbit. Why do we need to study the sun? What don't we know about the sun? You think we've been studying it all these years. What do we need to know about it, Louis?
Well, Ulysses is an absolutely unique mission. Up until the time of Ulysses, all the spacecraft that have been flown outside the Earth's gravitational attraction have been confined to the ecliptic plane of the solar system, the plane that all the planets are in. And Ulysses was the only spacecraft that's ever been launched perpendicular to the ecliptic plane, so that it can go out of the ecliptic plane over the polar regions of the sun to measure the interplanetary medium in three dimensions.
And what kinds of things is it looking to measure? What don't we know? What information will it send back to help us know about the sun or anything else?
Well, the sun connects to the Earth through the interplanetary medium. The hot outer atmosphere of the sun continually expands out through the interplanetary medium, filling the space between all of the planets. Mm-hmm. We have only measured those up until the time of Ulysses, the interplanetary medium, the magnetic fields, the charged particles, the waves, radio waves. We've only managed to measure those in the ecliptic plane. And so Ulysses has provided now a measurement of all those solar processes that are ejected into the interplanetary medium in the three dimensions, as you indicated, throughout the entire interplanetary medium. Now the data that have been acquired by Ulysses can be put into models that model the entire three-dimensional space, and we can have more confidence in the modeling that we do to model the impacts of solar processes on the Earth and even on the other planets.
Ed Smith, you published an article in the journal Science, called The Sun and Heliosphere at Solar Maximum.
Right.
Tell us a bit about what did you discover new about the sun, and what is this solar maximum you're talking about?
All right. Let me answer the first question last. The sun goes through this periodic change about every 11 years. The most obvious aspect of that is the waxing and waning of the sunspots. So that there's a large number of spots on the sun, and they're the ones which are associated with the solar activity that you mentioned at the top of the hour. And so it goes through a peak, then the sunspots gradually decrease, and the solar activity decreases. And then finally, about halfway through this 11-year cycle, we go through this minimum where things are nice and quiet. And as you said, ELISA's has been in operation now for a little over a decade, so we've had a chance to make this three-dimensional survey both at solar minimum and at solar maximum. And that's given us an unprecedented look at how the sun changes. This solar cycle of 11 years is basically driven by the sun's magnetic field, and that's something that we make direct observations of. And it influences all the other constituents in this heliosphere, this large bubble surrounding the sun that completely encloses the solar system. So it has a strong influence on the solar wind, which, as you were say, will be discussed later, on these energetic particles that Lou and his friends make, on the dust, including dust which is coming in from interstellar space, on the galactic cosmic rays, these relativistic particles that are coming in.
So while we think of the sun just being a hot ball in the sky,
yes,
it's a lot more complex
it certainly
going
is.
On up there.
And it emits a lot of material, and it produces a lot of magnetic fields, as Lewis said, waves, energetic particles, and it's a very complex integrated system. All these things interact in a very complicated way, and in ways which are unlike the kinds of phenomena that we find on Earth, largely because the densities in space are so low that there aren't any collisions between particles. The most important forces are electromagnetic, and the particles are strongly affected by the magnetic fields. So the magnetic fields play a crucial role in all these things, and since the magnetic field that we see in space originates on the sun, then we need to understand that connection.
What happened a month ago? I'm sorry, go ahead.
ELISA's has been absolutely critical in providing us the three-dimensional view of the magnetic field of the sun as it extends into the interplanetary medium. It has provided the measurements of the magnetic field on ELISA's has provided unprecedented new understanding of the magnetic field changes on the sun over the solar cycle.
Did you find that the magnetic field was shaped and acting the way you thought it was before there was ELISA's? Ed?
To some extent, we did, but there were some surprises. And those are the things which are documented in the science article. One of the interesting things about the sun's magnetic field that's been known for a long time is that as part of this 11-year cycle, the magnetic poles reverse polarity. This is the kind of thing that also happens on Earth, but on Earth it happens every few hundred thousand years, or a million years, whereas on the sun it happens every 11 years.
The poles actually flip over.
That's
every 11 years.
Yes. For example, the magnetic pole in the north, the field lines have been coming outward. And as a result of this recent solar maximum, they're now inward. So inward fields become outward fields and vice versa. So that's been known for some time. Mm-hmm. The way in which that occurs was not very clear. But what ELISA's has shown is that when these magnetic poles in the polar caps of the sun are disappearing, strong magnetic poles form down closer to the equator, and those are the ones which then provide the heliospheric magnetic field and influence the various phenomena that are going on. So that was one thing. That, to some extent, that was anticipated, although people didn't know whether the magnetic poles just rotated around from the poles down to the equator and then appeared in the opposite direction. But it appears that, in fact, now, from the ELISA's results, it's clear that the magnetic poles actually disappear in the polar caps of the sun, but at the same time, these very strong equatorial magnetic poles form down near the equator, and those are the ones which are responsible for much of the magnetic activity.
So they sort of disappear at the old poles and then bulge out again at a new spot,
that's right.
At the equator?
They appear at the equator. That's associated with the formation of these sunspots. Then as the sunspots decline away, at the same time, the polar cap magnetic fields are re-emerging with the opposite polarity, and then they become quite strong. And again, at solar minimum then, you have a situation where the magnetic field is dominated by magnetic poles in the polar caps, pretty much like the Earth. But at solar maximum, those poles have rotated down near the equator. So it's a very different kind of orientation.
Right.
The magnetic fields now behave very differently at solar minimum. The fields originate in the polar caps and then are deflected or diverge down to the equator. But the opposite is true in solar maximum.
So where are we now? Where are the poles now?
They have reversed both in the north and in the south.
Is that what caused this big event last month? What was that event all about? What happened there?
Oh, well, I think that Lou can answer that perhaps better than I can, but I think a very large sunspot group formed. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, the sunspots are basis of these active regions. There are strong magnetic fields in that region. It contained a lot of very hot gas, so-called plasmas, and very energetic particles. And the particles are restrained, again, by the magnetic field, but the magnetic fields occasionally get disrupted, and this material then takes off and goes out into space to form what's called a mass ejection. Substantial fraction of the solar corona actually then is propelled out into the heliosphere at quite high speeds. Mm-hmm. And if that can be seen from spacecraft that are viewing the sun and making images, when that kind of structure encounters the Earth, that's where you get large magnetic storms and aurora.
Lou?
Yes. Well, the magnetic activity over the last couple of weeks has been in the declining phase of the sunspot cycle, where the declining phase is defined by the number of sunspots are becoming fewer and fewer as time goes on, and we're headed back now to solar minimum. But it's not unprecedented that one might have a lot of solar activity during the declining phase of a cycle. That has been seen in a number of sunspot cycles. And precisely when during the declining phase that occurs is completely unknown, but it's not unknown to happen. And that's exactly what we found. And it's quite conceivable that this big active region that Ed described reappear and could persist and reappear again after it rotates around. The sun rotates with about a 27-day period, so 14 days from now, we might see an active region still there coming back to face the Earth again. Huh. And so this active region reconfigured all the magnetic fields, very intense magnetic fields in this active region, reconfigured themselves, converted energy from the magnetic fields into electromagnetic energy and into electric fields, which accelerated the charge particles and which blew off a substantial amount of the solar corona more than one time during a several-day interval there. And several of these hot coronal ejections came towards Earth.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking to Ed Smith and Lou Lanzarotti. So are you saying that it could still be blowing off these things, but it's turned around away from us and we don't see it, and once it turns back, we can get another whammo of it?
It's a lot like a searchlight in that respect. These active regions are localized, but as Lou has said, they rotate about once a month. Those the active regions, the spots, are now out of our view because they're behind the sun. But they can last many months, and they're likely to reappear, and the activity could continue for some time. Incidentally, I think as Lewis said, this is not unusual. This kind of outburst has happened the last several solar cycles, and it seems to be related to something. It's almost like the last gasp of solar activity.
We have about a minute before the break, but this was played up so big in the media, and it didn't seem to have that much of an effect, Ed. What happened here? Did the media just play this up too much, or were you scientists a little bit culpable in this?
Well, you know how responsibilities get distributed around. Yeah. We may have been partly responsible, but I think that the fact that this was a visible sunspot, there were fires in Los Angeles, and I know I talked to people who actually saw these large sunspots with the naked eye.
Wow.
So that was quite an unusual occurrence. It's happened before, but I think that's what prompted people to think there might be a lot of unusually large activity.
Wow. All right, we're going to take a short break and talk lots more about the sun. Take your calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about solar physics and the Ulysses mission with my guest, Ed Smith, NASA project scientist for the Ulysses mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Louis Lanzarotti, who's principal investigator for the Ulysses mission. He's working out of New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Louis, How big were those solar storms? And we were hearing that it depended on the orientation of the magnetic fields. Explain that a bit for us. I mean, why we didn't feel it so much.
Well, before I do that, I'd like to have a little introduction to that. In terms of the possible overselling of this activity, I think it should be pointed out that we really our understanding of solar activity and how it affects the Earth is really very primitive. And certainly very primitive compared to atmospheric weather and how we might predict that some atmospheric disturbance would affect various regions of the world, for example. And during the big hurricane that we had here on the East Coast earlier this fall, the prediction of its route was pretty good, but a lot of people prepared for it, and they didn't see the hurricane, and so therefore they said, well, what's the big problem? But those who got hit by the hurricane, of course, suffered quite a bit off the Grand Banks in North Carolina. And I think this last solar activity that you talked about was very similar to that kind of situation. This coronal mass, the largest coronal mass ejection that hit Earth and hit Earth's magnetic field, had its magnetic fields in the coronal mass ejection oriented in a way that tended to minimize some of the more severe damages to some of the technological infrastructure on Earth, such as, say, power grids or some long communication cables. But nevertheless, folks that had other kinds of space assets, some spacecraft, satellites, or, as you said in your introductory material, airline routes over the polar regions, were affected by this activity. The airlines had enhanced radiation predicted over the polar regions of the Earth, and that was exactly right. And so they had to reroute a number of polar flights in order to minimize the radiation exposure to passengers and crew.
And we even had to tell the space station astronauts to go into a protective
that's
mode,
correct.
Right?
And so
to shield themselves better.
That's absolutely right, and the prediction was right, and the shielding was necessary. But in terms of large disturbances of the Earth's ionosphere, which make anomalous currents, which then cause currents to flow in the Earth and affect pipelines, and that didn't happen. And that didn't happen principally because, as I said earlier, the magnetic fields were oriented in a similar direction. The Earth's magnetic field and the magnetic fields in this coronal mass ejection were oriented in a similar direction. It was like repulsive magnets behave. Your refrigerator magnets repulse one another when their magnetic fields are oriented in the same direction. And that's what happened in terms of producing magnetic storms on Earth. But if the magnetic field in the coronal mass ejection had been oriented oppositely, and we don't know that today, whether we cannot predict that from our primitive knowledge of the sun and the interplanetary medium, which direction that might be. But if they were oriented oppositely, your refrigerator magnets would attract one another. And the analogy is very poor for what happens in space, but the effect is the same. If they attract one another, then the magnetic disturbance on Earth and the magnetic storms would be much larger. And we avoided
Is it possible when the sun comes around again in its monthly rotation, so to speak, it could be oriented again differently and have a whole different effect? If there's a flare-up in it?
Indeed. If there's a flare-up and if the coronal mass ejections are ejected again, they could have a different orientation of the magnetic field. We have no way of predicting that from our current knowledge of the sun.
And you would like to get into the solar weather predicting business, would you not?
I would like to get into that business not just because I'm an interested scientist or engineer, but because it's really important for many of our technologies. The minute the human beings developed a telegraph, we developed a telegraph back 150 years ago. The effects of the sun on the telegraph were seen within a year or two of the deployment of the telegraph. And since then, our electrical technologies have vastly increased in number, as we know, from telecommunications, radio, wireless, satellites, power grids, pipelines, and all those things can be affected by space weather. And they all are affected in different ways by space weather. And we can't predict, we're very poor at predicting that. We're probably at the same stage of predicting space weather as atmospheric weather was 40, 50, 60 years ago. That seems to be the understanding right now. We've got a long way to go.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Mark in Detroit. Hi, Mark.
How are you?
Hi, go ahead.
I was curious about physicist McCanney, who says that a lot of these spots are caused by comets that are approaching the sun. Is there any truth to this?
Ed?
Yeah. I don't think so. It's true that there are comets which approach the sun, but I think the sunspots are well known to be a solar phenomenon. Again, it has to do with the way in which the sun's magnetic field develops and evolves over this complicated cycle. And the sunspots are basically regions in which the magnetic fields buoy up from the interior. So I would say it's a phenomenon.
Why are they dark, the sunspots?
Because they tend to be cooled. And so if you look at them in certain wavelengths, they're cooler and they appear dark. So they're losing some energy.
Well, would that correspond? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to mention that the SOHO spacecraft, the European U.S. spacecraft that looks at the sun, has seen many comets either grazed by the sun or impact the sun, and there's been no relationship, so far as the best knowledge exists, between the impact of one of those comets that they can monitor all the way to the sun and the appearance of a sunspot group or any activity.
So we couldn't draw an analogy between Jupiter and the result that happened when comets or debris asteroid had hit Jupiter versus...
It's fair to say that. That would be a very poor analogy.
All right. Mark, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. And what is the relationship to sunspots and this big flare, this ejection that we had a few weeks ago? Any relationship at all, Ed?
Well, yes. When these strong magnetic fields emerge from the interior to form the sunspots, then they are sources of these active regions, because what the sunspots basically represent, again, two magnetic poles with connecting field lines. The magnetic fields in these regions are very strong, so there's a lot of magnetic energy. And Lou had mentioned that when these events occur, there's a lot of this magnetic energy is converted into heat and particularly into the propulsion of these large masses of material out into space. So there is this intimate connection. Mm-hmm. And to go a little bit further, Lou was emphasizing that the direction of these fields can be very important. He mentioned that the direction of the field in these clouds as they approach the Earth influences how strong the interaction is with the Earth. And the same kinds of things go on in these sunspots, so that there are magnetic field lines which are adjacent to one another and oppositely directed in his analogy, where they're attracting. That's part of this release mechanism. And so a lot of this magnetic energy which originates within the interior of the sun as a magnetic field is what really releases all this material.
Dr. Lanzarotti, you testified to Congress, before Congress, on future solar research and where it needs to go. What do we have to do to get better at predicting solar weather, as you say, and knowing more about the sun?
Well, the National Research Council, several agencies of the government sponsored a major study on the future of solar and space physics research, which is basically what we're talking about here today. The NASA sponsored this. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sponsored this report. The National Science Foundation and the Office of Naval Research and the Air Force Office of Scientific Research all sponsored this study to give an idea of where we should be going in the future. And it was clear there that several challenges were laid out, and some missions and programs to address the challenges were proposed in this study that I was privileged to chair. And one of the major challenges was to trying to understand the structure and dynamics of the sun's interior and the generation of these magnetic fields using ever higher spatial and time resolution studies of the sun, both from space and from the ground, in both the optical wavelengths and in radio wavelengths in particular. And another challenge.
Do you need another satellite to get closer in, or what kind of hardware do you need for these things?
Well, there's several different kinds of hardware. Some is in progress now for visual measurements of the sun. There is a ground-based facility that was proposed here in radio waves to study the sun's using radio waves, interferometry, to study the sun at high spatial resolution in radio waves, because this magnetic energy that's converted puts out all kinds of radio waves as well, and they can tell us things about the solar corona as well. And this is a project that's being led by a colleague here at New Jersey Institute of Technology, Professor Dale Gary, called the Frequency Agile Solar Radio Telescope. That's a proposed mission that the National Science Foundation would be supporting and seems to be very supportive of, and it's beginning to move along. But there is also a major space mission, the Solar Probe mission, which is a really ambitious activity that has been studied for about 15 years, I think, originating at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the mid-80s. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. It is a proposed mission to go into the sun, into the sun's atmosphere, to within about 3 to 5 solar radii of the visible area of the sun, to measure the magnetic fields, the charged particles, and to do some imaging of the sun very close up. It would provide
take it inside Mercury's orbit?
Oh, yes, far inside Mercury's orbit.
I'm trying to give everybody an idea how far in you're talking about.
Indeed, far inside Mercury's orbit, at the upper regions of the solar corona. It's very hot there, as you can imagine, and so the technological challenges to doing that and to getting the data sent back are really formidable.
And so what would you collect? What would you get by going that close? What else could you do? I mean, if all the stuff is coming out of the sun, why do we have to get so close to it?
Well, one can be able to measure then in detail the all of the plasma physics processes that are going on that tend to form this activity that we see only later on in the solar system and in the interplanetary medium. So you'd be measuring near the source regions of where a lot of this activity is occurring, so that one can understand ultimately better the physical mechanisms there and model them better and provide better theories for them. Mm-hmm. It's like looking at the aurora from the ground. One can understand the aurora, and it's very nice, but only when we were able to fly rockets through the aurora and spacecraft through the aurora that we could measure the real physical processes that were producing the aurora around Earth. And so the solar probe is analogous to that.
If I can add a point, Ira.
Sure.
One of the things that sometimes people are confused about Ulysses is that it does not go close to the sun. When we say we go over the poles of the sun, we're still no closer to the sun than the Earth is. And our orbit actually, as you know, varies between the distances of the Earth and Jupiter from the sun. Mm-hmm. And Lou is perfectly right. We know enough about the sun, and it's such a dynamic environment, that the kinds of phenomena we see have been processed en route. And a lot of that does take place close to the sun, and that's why people are so anxious to go there and sample directly to see what has happened as part of this evolution.
Mm-hmm. Talking about solar research this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Go ahead, Lou. Do you want to say something?
Well, that's why I was just going to add one thing about this solar probe mission. Because of the nature of making these measurements very close to the sun, that's one reason why it was reached such a high priority in this study that was requested by all these agencies and that the Congress wanted to hear about.
Mm-hmm. Do we totally understand the physics of what's going on in the sun? It's just a big nuclear fusion reaction going on there. Ed, do we understand what's going on?
Oh, I think that as far as the deep interior is concerned and where the nuclear reactions are taking place that basically generate all of the energy, people think they understand that, although, as you know, there has been some mysteries associated with that. They've been cleared up recently. But the what happens is that the energy, as it expands out from this thermonuclear furnace in the interior, changes the way that energy is transported around, changes from radiation, very energetic radiation, X-rays, gamma rays, and whatnot, into a fluid motion. It's like the Earth's atmosphere, And the outer third or so, the outer quarter of the sun, is undergoing what's called convection. You know, these are the kinds of motions that occur in thunderstorms on Earth.
Are these photons floating around?
No, these are actually turning over of the fluid material inside the sun.
Made out of what? Fluid material made out of what?
Well, it's gases. It's mostly hydrogen, helium, yeah, right. But there's, of course, all the elements you find at Earth are in the sun. So it includes carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, metals of various kinds. And these cells form, and they begin to turn over. It's a way in which gases transfer heat from below to above. And that's a very dynamic process. It's very hard to model, but it's intimately related to the generation of the magnetic fields, it's believed.
I had heard that it takes something like 50,000 years for photons to start out inside the sun and reach their way to the surface and then escape off. Is that right? Is that an urban myth?
No, I think it's true, except the thing that may be confusing to most people is it's not the same photon. This is a process of what's called radiative transfer. The photons have to go through very dense material, so their path lengths are very short. So they start out in this nuclear furnace at very high energies, gamma rays, as I said, X-rays and whatnot, but then they're absorbed and re-emitted continually, and that's what takes a lot of time. And then finally, when they emerge, of course, they have much less energy than when they started because there's many more photons. You know, this energy has then been distributed into a much larger volume. Mm-hmm. Lou, did you want to comment on that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. When they emerge, they're about 6,000 degrees Kelvin now at the surface of the sun, the surface that Ed indicated that people were able to see through the smoke in Los Angeles fires.
Well, yeah, it's amazing that even through those fires they could see this, how active the sun was during this. So, well, we'll wait to see what happens in a few weeks, right? The sun will come around again, and it'll be exciting times for you guys again.
Oh, it will be, and I think there was a large eruption about a week ago that was seen. It was not headed toward Earth, but it was headed off what's called the limb of the sun. Well, it turns out that that's going precisely in the direction where Ulysses is located. Ulysses is now reapproaching Jupiter. So we think that we will see some very strong activity within the next week and the influence on Jupiter.
All right, Ed, thanks for joining us this hour. We have to say goodbye to Ed Smith, NASA's project scientist for Ulysses at JPL. We're going to have Lou's going to stay with us. We're going to switch gears and talk a little bit more about another really interesting topic, Voyager. Not V'ger, Voyager. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Now, where is the Voyager 1 spacecraft? No, it's not being taken over by V'ger like they made in the movie. Maybe it is, because we're having trouble finding exactly where it is. It's incredible. Few spacecraft have contributed as much to our understanding of the planets in our solar system as the Voyager space probes have. And NASA's Voyager 1 began its grand tour of the outer planets in 1977 it was launched. It's had close encounters with Jupiter and Saturn, and last week, after more than 25 years in space, more than 8 billion miles from the sun, it's reached the edge of the solar system. Or has it? Scientists writing in the journal Nature last week debated Voyager 1's exact location and whether it's found the edge of the solar system or not. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about Voyager 1's journey toward interstellar space. Why scientists disagree. Yeah, they do disagree about where the spacecraft is and the challenges of trying to figure out what is happening at the edge of the solar system. Ooh, sounds spooky. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce some of my guests. Joining us now is Merav Ofer. She is a Caltech postdoctoral scholar and a research scientist at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. She's here in our studios in NPR West in Los Angeles. Dr. Ofer, thank you.
Thank you.
For joining us. But still with us is Lou Lanzarotti. He is a co-investigator for NASA's Voyager mission, a consulting physicist at Bell Labs Lucent Technologies, and distinguished research professor in the Department of Physics Center for Solar Terrestrial Research at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lou, you, your research team and another research team published a paper last week in Nature on Voyager 1's journey to the edge of the solar system, where it's, you know, your group think it's there, but there's a little controversy about it. Explain it to us.
Well, it's such a very exciting time for Voyager that any controversy that exists is very friendly controversy among investigator teams who have worked together, as you noted, for 25 years after launch, but really more like 31 years since the inauguration of the Voyager program back in 72. So it's been a long time. We've all worked together, and we've all struggled together to understand the heliosphere with various instruments on Voyager.
Why do they think it's there? Yeah, why do they think it's at the edge of the solar system? What's the evidence?
Well, there? our instrument team thinks it's near the edge of the solar system, and in fact, at the edge of the solar system, where the solar wind that was described in by Ed Smith previously this hour reaches the interstellar medium, and the solar wind stops flowing. There's a shock wave set up between the sun. The sun's influence, the region of influence, and the local interstellar medium. And that shock wave, we believe, Voyager crossed and actually then re-entered back into the solar system because the shock wave seems to be very much like a balloon, can go in and out, and that's we believe we've crossed that. One or two of the other instrument teams on Voyager says that we may be very close, but we probably haven't reached the point where we've crossed it as yet, and that's where the friendly controversy arises.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ofer, what can you add to this? Do you think that they're out there? Or you make models of what this edge of the solar system should look like. Does it look like it? Is it a duck? Is it quacking?
There is another measurement of the magnetic field, and this basically the instrument that measures the magnetometer didn't see an increase of the magnetic field. And we expect, as a theoreticians and modelers, that the solar wind carries a magnetic field, and when it gets to the termination shock, when it suddenly slows down to 100,000 miles per hour, that it will compress the magnetic field of the sun almost like a sandwich against the interstellar wind, forming those magnetic walls. Mm-hmm. What we call. So we expected that, for example, the magnetometer will see an increase of magnetic field. So it's puzzling that he didn't see this increase. So this is another piece of the puzzle to try to understand. But as a modeler, like recently type of work that I've been doing with my colleagues at JPL, we were trying to put, it's very, very hard to model this, especially the edge of the solar system. It's so complicated. There's so many type of ingredients. I keep, in when I talk about this, saying it's like baking a cake. You need to
What kind of ingredients? Give
you
us
need
an
to
idea.
Add, yes, so what, for example, you need to include like charged particles.
Right.
You need to include neutral particles. And there is a lot of neutral particles from the interstellar medium.
Coming that, back toward Earth.
Yes, it just ignore this whole boundary and ignore the heliopause and just stream to the solar system. They interact with the charged particles, but they basically come toward us. And so there is high energy particles, and there is magnetic field.
Right.
There is both magnetic fields from the sun and from the interstellar medium. And we don't know from the interstellar medium even the direction or the intensity of this magnetic field. So, like, to try to really understand this region,
right,
especially at the edge when the magnetic field is being compressed, then he is like the major player.
What is so important to why we need to understand this region? What's the
because, for example, like when Voyager is now giving us these amazing results and they're all so contradictory, we would like, as a modelist, to look to this result and tell it's crossed or it didn't,
right,
termination shock. And when you try to kind of look in this area, you see that it's so turbulent, it's so complicated. That is a hard, like, for example, one of my results lately show that it's very turbulent. Maybe the magnetic field doesn't increase so close to the termination shock.
Huh. Lou, do you use these models to try to figure these things out?
I have not personally done so, but I've certainly been, I'm very familiar with them, and they certainly do influence our thinking about what's going on. But as was just pointed out, the physical processes in that region were expected to be and now are confirmed to be exceptionally complex. It's entirely different kind of physical region than anything human instruments have experienced to date. The densities of the plasmas there, the charged particles and the magnetic fields are very, very low, much different than anything we've measured to date. And then you have this admixture, as was noted, of the neutral particles and the very high energy cosmic rays, and that makes for a soup or a cake,
cake.
Analogy. a cake analogy that is really very complex, and you change a little bit of the yeast or something, and the physics, we just don't know the detailed physics of that region.
And
it's like a wall. Yeah, it's like you go like was very, like he was pointing out, very low densities, very low magnetic field, and then suddenly you have this intense wall, the termination shock that increased abruptly the density and the magnetic field. So you have very dramatic changes.
Is this 30-year-old spacecraft still able to function and send back information that is so useful, Lou, to us?
Well, it's been an incredible mission. Everybody involved with Voyager from the beginning has feel that we're so lucky that the spacecraft has operated just essentially flawlessly. The instrumentation has, with one exception on Voyager 1, has operated flawlessly. It's just remarkable. One of the unfortunate things is that the spacecraft and the instrumentation weren't designed for this kind of a mission, lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as might be expected, an instrument has failed. And the key instrument that failed on Voyager 1 was the solar wind instrument. So we have no direct measures of the solar wind at that location. We can only infer what they are, and that's what we've tried to do with the measurements from our instrument, and one of the reasons why we concluded that we probably did cross the boundary, because we've inferred from our instrument measurements that the solar wind velocity probably did drop very, very low, if not, and was consistent with zero solar wind velocity.
Could it be possible, as Dr. Ofer is saying, that it's sort of ballooning in and out, so it sort of drops in and out of the boundary shifts? The goalposts are moving as you try to score a touchdown?
Absolutely. I think Dr. Ofer's model that shows that the boundary can move in and out like a balloon is absolutely right. And as solar activity increases, one would expect the ultimately, it takes solar activity about a year to propagate to that distance, or more than a year. And I would expect that the boundary could move away, and Voyager may be back inside for some substantial time, given the solar activity. She can probably address that better than I.
Talking about Voyager this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News with Mirav Ofer and Lou Lanzarotti. Dr. Ofer, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I was just going to add that, for example, just to add like another mixture to the dough, like, for example, when you have this sandwich of magnetic field after the termination shock, there is a region in space when you don't have a magnetic field, because this is when the solar magnetic field changed direction. And what we saw recently in our models, that this region start to oscillate. In this region, the solar wind, because there is no magnetic field there, he streams like a jet. And this jet perturbs the magnetic walls and start to create so much turbulence that I remember when I saw now the data that the magnetometer didn't see an increase of magnetic field, I thought, maybe it's crossing this area that there is no magnetic
field. Well, how long a time does the needle have to stay at zero before you agree that with Lou that it is now past? What do you have to see to convince you that it's outside?
I would like to see in a couple of years from now an increase of magnetic field, and to convince me in this kind of scenario that I have, because the way that we are seeing that is oscillating up and down this jet and perturbing those magnetic walls. But there are regions when there is an increase of magnetic field.
So you need a couple of years.
Yes.
Time.
Yes.
I agree with that. I think we need another year, at least a year, and maybe probably two more of measurements. But it could be complicated because of all the solar activity that we've had recently.
Right.
Could perturb that boundary even more and push it further out. And her model would probably predict that.
Is Voyager the farthest spacecraft out there, or was Pioneer further, or
In 1998, Voyager passed Pioneer, as the farthest object.
And where is Voyager 2 now?
Voyager 2 is, if I'm not mistaken, Lou, you can correct me, like 20 AU behind Voyager 1?
Yes, that's right. Voyager 2 is about 20 astronomical units behind Voyager 1.
Is it working? Is it still working?
Yes. All the instrumentation on Voyager 2 is working, including the solar wind instrument. And so
that's
exciting.
This will be very exciting.
Very exciting.
So you guys have jobs for a few more years,
exactly. Then. Exactly. We need to improve the models. It's a race.
Do you have a side bet? Any side bets going on here?
I don't think so, but we may want to do that. There have been some side bets for a number of years on the location of some side bets by cosmic ray physicists. Every couple or 3 years has been a meeting of the outer heliosphere meeting, and people take bets. And the boundary has continued to move out. Well, when I started in the space business back in the 1960s, the boundary was thought to be between Mars and Jupiter. I published a paper in the late 1960s with a Bell Labs colleague in Nature where we predicted it to be about 5 AU at the orbit of Jupiter.
Wow.
And so ever since those two, that boundary has continued to move outward. And that's one of my, that paper is one of my more infamous papers.
You got that on the wall, do you?
Yes, I've got that on the wall. Absolutely.
And now your colleagues won't let you forget. They're going to look at your track record now and say, look.
That's right.
All right. I want to thank you both for taking time. And this shows you that, physics can be fun also.
Exactly.
It's exciting.
It certainly can.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank both of my guests, Mira Bofer of Caltech, postdoctoral scholar, and research scientist at JPL here in Pasadena, and Lou Lanzarotti, co-investigator for NASA's Voyager mission. He's also a consulting physicist at Bell Labs Lucent Technologies and a distinguished research professor in the Department of Physics Center for Terrestrial Research at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. Thank you both for joining us. And
thank you for
We're going to have you back to debate this, and, maybe new data comes in. All right?
We'll be happy to come back.
Yes,
all right, terrific. Earlier we spoke with Ed Smith of NASA's, he's a project scientist for the Ulysses mission at JPL also. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Verghoff. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. And we had help today and certainly need it from Spencer Graves in Newark and Carlos Asensio here in Los Angeles. And if you'd like to write us, please surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have Science Friday's Kids Connection there. We make free curricula for students, teachers. You can use it in your schools. Take Science Friday with you into the classroom. And also you can listen to past editions of Science Friday in real audio in the archives, or you can download them in your subscription to your audible.com player. I'm Ira Flatow in Los Angeles.